Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, managing partner at VS Strategies. As always, we're going to give thanks to RootWorks, our sponsors, and our amazing producer, Josh, who is killing it as always, keeping us in line. And so we have a really cool show today, and in fact, a series of shows. So last time we recorded our first ever two-parter, where we talked about Ohio, and we have some really cool stuff planned for the next couple of months here at the Weed Wonks. The first of which is going to start today, which is going to be a three-part series on product safety and cannabis testing. Lots of really interesting issues going on right there. So we're going to record our first part in this three-part series. And we have a couple surprise bonus episodes coming up. I've had some nerdy lawyer friends come up with some wonky ideas that they've gotten published recently and want to have them on the show to talk about those. But those will be shorter bonus episodes. But we're going to do a three-part kind of more typical episode, which starts today, a very important day, where we're going to talk about testing issues. And to get us started on those issues, one of the most interesting things that has happened in cannabis testing policy in the last year has been going on in Mississippi. And so we are going to talk about what's happening in Mississippi. And to do that, we have our good friend, Executive Director of 3MA, Henry Chrysler, joining us today to be our guest on the show. Henry, thank you so much for taking the time to join the Weed Wonks.
Thank you, Jordan. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
So before we get started on the place we always like to start, which is how Henry came into cannabis policy and what he's doing, and then we talk about some of the other stuff and testing in Mississippi, there is a very important thing happening today beyond the importance of cannabis testing policy. And I know you're thinking to yourself, what could be more important than cannabis testing policy? Well, I'll tell you what's more important than cannabis testing policy. It is Henry's birthday. Now, let's be very clear. The day you're listening to this is not Henry's birthday, just so you know. Today, the day we're recording it, is Henry's birthday, February 22nd. And so I would like all of our amazing audience to wish Henry a happy birthday. And just to get started, we are going to subject our entire audience to the audio stylings of myself and our producer, Josh, and embarrass Henry a little bit by singing happy birthday to him. So, Josh, and let's go.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Henry. Happy birthday to you.
Cha cha cha.
Cha cha cha.
Thank you guys. I appreciate it.
No problem. Well, you are an awesome person that we get to work with, and our team has been working with 3MA and the folks in Mississippi and on that campaign for a long time. It's a market we've been really excited about and think it's just a super fascinating cannabis market as it's developed on the medical side, and looking forward to great things to come. Really a growing market, one of the ones folks aren't talking about. So you get the pleasure of working with some really fantastic folks, people who have a lot of experience in the Mississippi market at 3MA, and that's how you and I have gotten to know each other. So before you started doing cannabis policy, how did you kind of get involved in the political and policy world in Mississippi?
So I've kind of always been a politico since very young. I went to school for political science. I've been dealing with in political campaigns since college. When I graduated in 2019, I got involved on the Initiative 65 campaign, which was the original public initiative campaign to bring medical cannabis to Mississippi. And I've sort of stuck around ever since. It felt like my niche and I wanted to stay there. So. I love it.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, tried and true method to get involved in stuff is get involved in the campaign, find yourself a role. And if you're a hard worker and a hustler and sharp, you can kind of build from there. You know, Andrew Livingston, someone you and I both know through our work together, you know, who's the director of economics and research at Vicente Law Firm, started out as an unpaid glorified intern on the Amendment 64 campaign. He was a volunteer. He came out and did volunteer work on the campaign. Then after the campaign won, he hung around and did volunteer work on implementation of legalization. And then he got a full-time job and they hired me and they said, okay, Andrew and Jordan, you know what all these rules are. You go build a compliance department. And we built a regulatory and compliance practice together. And so, you know, same thing, right? You kind of make yourself indispensable, right? And I think that that's an important lesson for young folks. If they're thinking, how do we get in? How do we get involved? You know, you kind of sucks sometimes. I've done it. I think I was a barn attorney making $400 a week at one point, which was not cool, but didn't help with the law school loans. But it's just kind of part of how it works. If you kind of show up and make yourself indispensable, the next thing you know, you've got fancy titles like executive director or director of economics and research because you became indispensable through your experience that you gained by being willing to kind of show up.
Totally agree. Totally agree. It's all about earning your stripes, I think, in politics and probably in cannabis too.
In politics and cannabis and in a lot of phases in life, right? You have to, you know, no one's going to pay you because in some very rare instances, a degree will help you land a well-paying job. But for the most part, people are looking for experience. And if you're going to volunteer on that campaign, you're probably going to build experience that you just can't get at school. You can't pay for it. It's a unique kind of situation. So you in that role of executive director at 3MA, you run the state's premier trade association for cannabis businesses. And give us a little sense generally about, you know, 3MA and your involvement there and what you guys are doing to support your members. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some specific pieces of legislation that you guys are working on also.
Sure. So 3MA, or the Mississippi Medical Marijuana Association, is the premier lobbying trade association for the state of Mississippi. We've formulated 3MA after the passage of Initiative 65 and what happened with the Supreme Court shutting it down due to the unconstitutionality of the ballot initiative process, which is all that to say, we formed 3MA in order to bring back the Medical Cannabis Act through the legislature back in 2020. And so we've been here ever since trying to make transformative changes to the law. I think every year since the Medical Cannabis Act passed, we have introduced new legislation that has altered or changed or improved the program in some way.
Yeah. And through rulemaking as well, lots of technical written comments, fantastic, you know, work and relationships, both with critical legislators, as well as, you know, being very effective with the regulatory agencies themselves, right? And 3MA does a great job on both fronts, as well as putting together some awesome events, updates for members. You know, one of the nice parts I always think is, you know, it's great to kind of advocate for folks, but being able to kind of communicate the advocacy, the value of that, call for ideas for improvements. 3MA has done a great job of member engagement as well.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, we actually just had one of our first events of 2024 last night in Tupelo. It was extremely well attended. Got to meet a lot of some of our members and some of the non-member operators in the Northeast Mississippi area. And it was a great time. I think this is one of the only industries, I don't have much experience in other industries. I've kind of been working in cannabis since college, but I just think it's unique that we can put, you know, direct competitors in a room together and they can share a beer and converse about the industry and how to improve it. There's a real sense of community amongst our operators here in Mississippi. And, you know, we're so grateful to be a small part of that community and help facilitate that.
Yeah. And I've had the pleasure of coming out a couple of times to Mississippi for the events. Some of them unfortunately these days with Zoom, you don't kind of get on planes as much. And so we'll present remotely more frequently, which is not nearly as fun as being in the room with everybody. But I do highly recommend folks to kind of check out what's going on in Mississippi, to check out what's going on at 3MA. If there's an opportunity or in a way to engage in the market there, I think it's a fantastic market. You've got a great group of growing businesses and a growing organization. And, you know, it's been awesome getting to work there. And, you know, we'll never forget my first trip out. And they were like, you got to get the redfish. And I was like, okay, sounds good. I always like fish that are based on a color. Being a good Jersey boy, we had a lot of bluefish back in the day. And so tried out that redfish and it was excellent. I mean, I also think the food down there, as with most places in the South, the food is excellent as well. So if you need an extra reason to go to Mississippi, great people, great cannabis program and tasty eats, which, you know, how can you beat all of that? So before we get into the testing situation, you know, Mississippi, the Mississippi legislative session is kind of shaping up to being an interesting, you know, kind of, I think, shift in the market in Mississippi, in the sense that you guys have a few years under your belt. You know, we got the basic program off the ground, made some really good tweaks and changes in the last couple of years. But this year, I think there's a big push for kind of significant changes on two fronts. The first one being really what, you know, we like in the trade call an omnibus bill, which I'm sure most folks listening to this know about. Basically, it means a pile of shit put together that maybe doesn't have a coherent theme other than the fact that we're making lots of changes to the same thing at once. So we're going to call it the omnibus, and everyone's got to get on the omnibus to get their thing changed. And you guys are working on a pretty significant piece of legislation that's not, you know, watershed changes, but lots of little fixes and technical changes to various aspects of the program to make it operate better. And that's a huge value add for the members. So can you talk a little bit about what you're working on there and what would be in that bill?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, from the very beginning, we've known that, you know, we were going to have to make consistent improvements or changes to the program. This year, it is looking like we are going to have one of the most transformative years if we're successful at the Capitol. But the omnibus bill that we've been working on with Vicente Cederberger, with VS Strategies for a few months now, it tackles a lot of the major obstacles of the cannabis program. So from the very beginning of this program, the marketing and advertising restrictions on our operators are pretty strict. I think it's pretty unique amongst medical cannabis programs across the country. I think we're one of the strictest, wherein any form of mass media, radio, television, billboard advertisements, even social media posts are pretty restricted for our licensed operators. So it's been really difficult to get the word out, to spread public awareness, public education about the program. And we believe pretty strongly that we're going to be able to tackle that. We're going to remove a lot of those restrictions. One of the other major things we're hoping to tackle in that omnibus bill is the removal of qualifying conditions. So at the beginning of the program, the legislature laid out a list of, I think, 25 qualifying conditions that would allow you as a patient to get access to medical cannabis. We believe now that the legislature feels it is the time to relinquish that and give it back to the discretion of practitioners. And we believe that that should have been the way it was at the very beginning. I think this is probably one of the only industries where our lawmakers feel the need to get in between doctors and patients in regards to healthcare. So we think the legislature is going to step back away from that and give it back to the practitioners, which we think will open up the market exponentially. We know at least we approximate about 40% of the people that are applying for a medical cannabis card currently are being denied because of the lack of one of those qualifying conditions. So at the very least, we will get grant access to those people. And we've seen estimates of doubling to tripling our patient count over the next 12 to 18 months if that legislation is successful. One of the other things we're hoping to tackle this year in that omnibus bill is the system of allotments for our patients. So we have a pretty unique, I think there's one other state, and Jordan, you'd probably be better to talk about this, but is it Missouri or Michigan that has a system of units? So we have a Mississippi Medical Cannabis Equivalency Unit, which is a system of allotment for our patients, wherein one unit equals 3.5 grams of cannabis flower, 1 gram of cannabis concentrate, or 100 milligrams of cannabis edibles. And currently, patients are limited to, I think, 6 of those units per week and 24 of those units per month, which is pretty limited, especially when it comes to the concentrates and edibles market. I think currently we are sort of incentivizing in the program a smoking program. And I don't think that's what the legislature intended with that MMCEU system. So I believe they're going to move away from that and move to a much more simple system, not only for our operators, but for our patients. I believe the way we will begin to measure it after this legislation passes is through just basic THC content. So we're hoping to have a basic 30 to 40 gram limit per month per patient in total THC, which will not only allow them to make the buying process for cannabis a lot simpler, but it'll allow them access to more of the products that they need to aid in their illnesses or their pain.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think all three of those are very different, right? That's where we started is there's lots of different stuff in here. There's still some more goodies that we'll get to, but just on those first one, you know, advertising and marketing in cannabis is always an incredibly complicated political conversation. And it sometimes cannabis business members don't help themselves, right? Like I think we've all seen some advertisements over the years around cannabis where we're like, yeah, you know, I just kind of like wish you didn't do it that way. Like that's not the classiest way to go about things. And, you know, I'm always of the opinion that, you know, you gotta be, you know, you gotta kind of take the high road. You gotta be classy with these kinds of things. You can't do things that are kind of gonna make us look bad or look irresponsible. Because we're fighting for drug policy reform, and that rests on the idea that people think we're going to be responsible. They're going to trust us with the privilege of having this industry, and there are legitimate health concerns about having a cannabis industry, and that the way you advance that is by showing, no, you can trust us with this responsibility, right, that the public can trust us. And so that those have always been very restrictive because public health people have a lot of concerns about them. But at the same time, it's America and we have free speech rights. So you kind of have to balance out, you know, those things. And I think different states have taken different approaches. And hopefully what we'll see is kind of a really strong combination over time of normalized advertising opportunities for cannabis businesses. And then the cannabis businesses taking that privilege and moving forward in a responsible way so that, you know, you and I aren't on the phone talking about a billboard in Mississippi with a bunch of, you know, cartoon characters smoking weed and a bunch of people angry about it. Cause like, I don't think that's going to help anybody either.
Absolutely. Yeah, we totally agree. The association, I mean, we want to see those restrictions lifted, but lifted responsibly. You know, we believe our operators are responsible enough to provide marketing and advertising that meets the requirements for public education and public awareness without going a step too far, like you said, with cartoon characters and, you know, appealing to children, which we think, you know, the operators in Mississippi understand that, and they understand the, you know, the atmosphere surrounding Mississippi. We are in the deep South here. So there's a lot of people concerned. You know, there's a lot of conservative, you know, mindsets and views in the state of Mississippi. So I do think if those advertising restrictions are removed, that our operators will act responsibly, and not, you know, create commercials, appealing to children or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah. And I mean, you also mentioned sales equivalencies. Those are, you know, different in every state. We all have different versions of them. They're all kind of weird and tricky and difficult. And I think, you know, one of the hard parts is, you know, it's easy to say you can buy, you know, an ounce of cannabis. In Colorado, medical patients can buy 2 ounces of cannabis in a single transaction. You know, okay, you can put that in a ballot initiative, everything that makes sense. But what is it 2 ounces of cannabis in concentrates? What is 2 ounces of cannabis? What is the equivalent in edibles? And then things start to get really weird. And I think you end up with programs that are, you know, maybe not intentionally, but maybe sometimes there's unintended consequences of policy. And in those unintended consequences of policy, you end up restricting patient access in a way that, you know, you probably weren't thinking about when you were trying to figure it out or trying to figure out the practicality of it. And so always been a very supportive person of monthly purchase limits as opposed to daily purchase limits. We have daily purchase limits here in Colorado. I think we would have been smarter, especially when we did our 1317, kind of a cleanup public safety oriented bill around purchase limits on the medical side, among other things. We kept a daily limit, and we should have without question gone to a monthly limit. So I think the structure that you're proposing will give patients the flexibility they need to make their own decisions, which is similar to also the removal of qualifying conditions, which most states have qualifying conditions, I think out of political necessity more than anything else, right? We're not going to just let doctors run amok. People have concerns about what happened with opiate prescriptions and things like that. Thankfully, cannabis is far less detrimental and concerning on a public health perspective than opiates. So there's always been like, well, you can get cannabis for this and not that. You can get cannabis for this and not that. And you know, maybe we should just let doctors make those decisions and not politicians, because most politicians never went to medical school. Most lawyers never went to medical school. Basically, everybody in the soup making the decisions about qualifying conditions, almost none of them are qualified to make the decision about qualifying conditions, and we should let doctors do it. And I think you can see some of the negative kind of externalities of those things when you talk about, for example, autism, right? A lot of the folks that I knew when I was working on the autism issue, they found out that cannabis helped their children's autism because their child had epilepsy also. And so they were treating their child for epilepsy with cannabis, and all of a sudden their autism got better. And I'm not going to pretend like I'm a medical doctor, but like, that seems to be a failure of the system, right? Like, if you can only get it. And so we had these parents, and Colorado eventually added autism to the list of qualifying conditions. But it makes the point that you had two parents standing next to you with autistic children. One is saying, my child has epilepsy, so I can give him cannabis and it's helping his autism. See how it's helping. And then you have another parent saying, if I gave my child cannabis to help with his autism, Child Protective Services could put me in jail. And like, it's just not logical, right? Like, and the person who's making the decision around what should and shouldn't be done is not a medical doctor. And so, you know, getting the legislature out of that decision, I think, will also really help folks. I mean, increasing patient counts, if you got 40% of people who think they could be benefited in a palliative way by cannabis being rejected, that's not helping people. That's not the point of all this. And I think we can just let doctors make the best decisions for their patients. And then they can make uniquely tailored decisions also to that individual, not, hey, these are the things doctors are allowed to do with their patients, which I, you know, I've never met a legislator that really, you know, has a space in there outside of obviously making sure like big picture public health crises aren't occurring.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what else is in the omnibus?
So there's a laundry list of potential changes or hopeful changes that we're looking for in this bill. One of the other things, so Mississippi currently has a 60% THC cap on concentrate products in Mississippi. We would love to see that removed. We think that there are, especially in certain cases, there's definitely a need for higher potency products such as RSO for certain patients, you know, in terminal stages of cancer and in extreme palliative need. And so one of the things that we hope to see is the removal of that 60% cap so that our operators can start offering a wider array of products that are higher potency for patients that need that.
Yeah.
There's a number of ordinances there are distance requirements and things like that surrounding where operators can be. We're hoping to relieve some of those. Obviously, some of them are necessary. We don't want, you know, dispensaries right next to each other or dispensaries right next to a nursing home or a nursery or a children's education center. But we do think that there are certain instances where operators or patients could benefit from having more availability of locations in which to place a dispensary or a cultivation facility that would provide better access for patients. We currently have 17 counties across the state of Mississippi that have actually opted out of the program altogether. So those counties actually don't have the patients that live within those counties don't have access to a dispensary with which to purchase cannabis. And so they're having to drive, you know, a significant distance in order to pick up their medicine, which is another thing we're hoping to change is you spoke about Colorado's daily limit. So we currently have a 7-day rolling limit on patients as well as a monthly limit. So not only is that confusing for patients, but it's requiring patients to go to dispensaries on a weekly basis to purchase their medicine instead of, for instance, pharmaceuticals, where they can go to a pharmacy and pick up, you know, a 30-day prescription. So we're hoping to remove that 7-day rolling average and just move to a 30-day average or a 30-day allotment, which we think will benefit all patients, but especially patients that are, you know, do not have adequate access to a dispensary, especially those in those 17 counties that I mentioned earlier. So hopefully that will be a major benefit to all patients, removing that 7-day average.
Yeah. And I mean, I, you know, when I pick up my prescriptions at the pharmacy, I can get a 90-day supply. And I even think that's a pain in the ass, right? I'd be like, hey, I, you know, my doctor says I'm on this medication for the foreseeable future. Could you just like mail this to me? You know? And so the idea that people have to go once a week, you know, as opposed to once a month, or, you know, in the case of other, you know, prescriptions, 90-day supplies are becoming more and more normative. So I think you've got, you know, kind of this, you know, kind of culture around the way we're dispensing medicine that's kind of evolved, and people are getting longer supplies and easier access for patients, kind of reducing the administrative burden of kind of constantly refilling prescriptions. As that kind of, you know, the way that we've gone about that has evolved over, especially since the pandemic. And now in Mississippi, we're going once a week to a dispensary for our medicine. That obviously is not a patient-friendly approach. You know, people have concerns. They want to make sure things are tightly regulated up front. But I think Mississippi program has shown to be very effective and very successful. And I think the businesses and the patients have earned the trust of saying, okay, we can relax this a little bit and we can go to a monthly purchase limit. And I think would be much better for everyone involved. So without getting into all the nitty gritty details, anything else worth mentioning in the omnibus? I don't want to skip anything awesome and important, but I also know there's probably some like kind of bottom level fodder that people can read for themselves and maybe isn't the most exciting thing in the world.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a number of changes that we haven't mentioned, including there's been a large push for increased education for our operators here in the state. There has been, since the program's very beginning, a requirement for those that work within a cannabis establishment to receive continuing education throughout the year. But unfortunately, that requirement hasn't been enforced. And I don't really think there's very many avenues or resources for our Mississippi cannabis workers to receive education on cannabis and how the program works. So I do think that there will be a large push to increase the avenues for education, and probably increase requirements for education, which, you know, could go either way for us. I mean, we are very supportive of having experts, you know, growing and cultivating and processing our medicine. So the more educated and adequate and experienced they can get, the better, we think, for patients and operators.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a podcast sponsored by a company that specializes in training and education, and that's what they're all about, we will certainly promote the cause of having the most educated workforce and really making it easy for folks, right? And I think that's, you know, having worked with RootWorks for a long time, one of the things that I always think is important when you think about education and continuing education, you know, is it timely? Is it relevant? And is it accessible? As someone who's had to go through continuing legal education requirements for many, many years, I can tell you that most of the time it's not very relevant to what I actually do on a day-to-day basis. In fact, I'm listening to them now, and most of what I'm listening to has nothing to do with what I do on a day-to-day basis. But every once in a while, you find a cannabis law CLE or some of these other things. But a lot of times, you know, training can be tricky and difficult and costly. And so finding ways to make sure people are getting the necessary training and businesses are providing the necessary training to keep people safe, but also giving them avenues to do it in a way that is effective is critical to having a great trained workforce and in addition, a safe industry. So speaking of a safe industry, there's another piece of legislation that you all have been working on to help, you know, kind of what I would say, align the cannabis policy in Mississippi with the intent of the legislature and the voters. And that deals with intoxicating hemp products.
Yes. So we have been working on legislation in regards to the intoxicating hemp market. So the Delta 8, Delta 10 THCA market here in Mississippi, which is a pretty prevalent industry. I mean, if you walk into any gas station or vape shop in the state of Mississippi, you're going to find, you know, a large array of what we tend to call intoxicating hemp products, which we sort of look at, and I think our legislature looks at it similarly, as sort of a rogue adult use or recreational market, which I don't think is the intention of our legislators. I think eventually one day we will get to a recreational market, but I don't think there's enough political will in the state of Mississippi for that to happen just yet. But there is currently a sort of adult use or recreational market through these Delta 8, Delta 10 THCA products. These are all legal through the 2018 Farm Bill, you know, and the federal legality of this, it makes it very difficult to sort of regulate it. But we do think that we have developed a piece of legislation that will withstand scrutiny and that will provide sort of strict regulations regarding the sale and distribution and sourcing of these products and also the testing of these products. So one of the things that was really concerning to us, we had a cannabis testing lab at the end of last year go around and purchase some of these intoxicating hemp products and run pesticide panels and THC potency panels on these products. And the results of them were incredibly alarming. A lot of these products are, you know, contain THC, you know, in excess of 10 to 15 times what their label has on the package. A lot of them are filled with heavy metals, pesticides, you know, all sorts of dangerous ingredients that you wouldn't want in a consumable product. And so if we are able to, with this piece of legislation, sort of fold that market in to the medical cannabis program and require strict testing requirements, sourcing requirements, and sale requirements, we think that we can not only protect consumers, but we can protect our medical cannabis industry. We feel it's only really a matter of time if we let these products stay unregulated. That it's only a matter of time before someone is harmed through the consumption of one of these products, and that will indirectly give it the black eye to our medical cannabis program. So we're in strong support of legislation that would regulate that industry. And in fact, a bill in the Mississippi House was just dropped. It was uploaded onto the Mississippi Legislature's website yesterday. That's House Bill 1676, if anyone's interested and wants to go read it. But it would do exactly what I just described, sort of fold that intoxicating hemp market into the medical cannabis program, which I think will satisfy our operators, our patients, and the legislature.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about responsibility in advertising. You know, I think that this, from my perspective, falls along the same lines, right? The future of drug policy reform rests on the perception of non-drug users thinking that people who use drugs are responsible, right? Because there's we're a democracy and there's less than 50% of the population uses cannabis or other illegal drugs. So we need to convince the people who aren't using them that we're responsible people and we'll do the right thing. And unfortunately, I'm not going to just jump on board and say that these products are legal. In fact, it's my opinion that they are in direct violation of multiple federal statutes. They're not controlled substances under DEA jurisdiction, but that does not mean that they are compliant with product safety laws and food safety laws and the FDCA and other truth in advertising and other kind of laws and regulations. But critically, you know, we are in a democracy. And the elected officials and the people of Mississippi voted for a medical cannabis program. They voted to say that if you are selling products that contain THC and that get people high, the only way to access those products in Mississippi is through this medical cannabis program that we have created. And I you know, reached a point where I just, hemp and marijuana are fictions. They're not real. It's not a thing. It's just cannabis. And if it gets you high, it's weed. And maybe it's an easier way to just use a colloquialism. And the people in Mississippi said, if you want to buy weed, this is the only way that you're allowed to buy weed. And while I think Mississippi, and I think all states, should adopt a fully regulated, comprehensive cannabis program that would allow people over the age of 21 to purchase and use cannabis without being criminalized, I am not an elected official in Mississippi. And until I am one, my opinion doesn't count. The elected officials and the people of Mississippi's opinions count, and this is the structure that they have created. And so it is irresponsible for us to take advantage of a loophole in violation of federal law to sell these products, and in many cases, not even through appropriate age gating. A lot of these companies, you can buy them online without even having to say you're over 21. And I think that that is an irresponsible choice that folks are making. And if the people of Mississippi want to say that the only way to access these products is through a medical marijuana store, then that is their prerogative. That is the prerogative of the people of Mississippi and their elected representatives. And we shouldn't be trying to find a way to go around that. We should say, okay, we're responsible people. You have given us this avenue and this channel and this pathway. We think it should be wider and changed, but we are going to act responsibly within the channel and pathway we've been provided. And we will continue to fight for the expansion of that channel, but that going around it is not going to lead to our ultimate goal. Going around it is going to demonstrate irresponsibility, which in most cases will, you know, I think better, more likely than not, harm our ability to advance drug policy reform, not help us advance drug policy reform. And if ending the drug war is the North Star, if ending cannabis prohibition is the North Star, then these things need to be seen through that lens. And so without getting into the specifics of the bill and the exact THC caps that different states are going to have, and everyone's got some different version of it, which probably is a nightmare, you know, and then some states like Minnesota have adopted 5 milligram food and beverages, and they're regulating them. And Kentucky has taken a different approach. But the elected representatives and the people of those states have chosen affirmatively that that is how they would like to see things regulated in their state. And I think that that's very, very different than, you know, kind of the unregulated situation that's going on now. And I, you know, I just applaud Mississippi for making a decision, right? Because I think, you know, we can get into whether people are making the right or wrong decision. And that might, you know, based on your business or your other perspectives, indicate what you think is right or wrong. But I think what we can say for certain, and what, you know, the testing that you did mentioned, is you may, not making a decision is a dangerous public health situation. Either don't allow them through some marijuana channel, or allow them through a regulated hemp market like Kentucky has chosen to do. But don't put your head in your sand and do nothing, because at a bare minimum, products with levels of THC that cause someone to get high should not be sold to people under the age of 21 unless they have a medical diagnosis from a doctor, right? So, you know, I think above all, like, I'm just glad Mississippi is doing something, and whatever they're going to choose to do, and I'm sure what you guys are doing is very responsible and seems like a very kind of balanced approach to say, hey, this is how you can access these products in Mississippi. This is how you're going to be allowed to access them, and you can still access them. They just are going to come through these specific stores because that's how we've said you can access it. And I'm glad that something is happening.
Yeah, these products, you know, aren't necessarily dangerous as long as they are, you know, tested and we know exactly what's in these products. So one of the major issues is that there really aren't strict requirements on the testing of these products currently. So, you know, regardless of the age requirement, you know, if I purchase it from a gas station, I really honestly have no idea what's in it. Whereas if you go to a medical cannabis establishment, a dispensary, every product within that dispensary has a certificate of analysis from a licensed medical cannabis testing lab here in Mississippi to test for all of the products within it. You know, if it's not safe to be on the shelves and be consumed, it won't make it to a dispensary. Whereas in a gas station or a vape shop, you really have no idea what's in it. So it could be extremely dangerous and adverse for your health. So we think Mississippi is making the right decision here in folding it into the medical cannabis program and requiring those strict testing requirements that we have for medical cannabis.
Yeah, which is what the policymakers and elected representatives of Mississippians thought they were requiring when they adopted the medical program, right? Like, I don't think they intended for this parallel system to exist. In fact, they did nothing. There was just a loophole in a federal law that is being run with. So speaking of testing and the thing that we are kind of kicking off here in our three-part conversation series where we want to talk a little bit about testing, Mississippi has had an absolutely fascinating, maybe fascinating for those outside of Mississippi, probably like disastrous and stress-inducing for those inside Mississippi is probably a little different.
Yeah, I would say devastating, not fascinating, but depending on the perspective, for sure.
Me calling it fascinating might be a little insensitive to the folks who lived through it, but it was just an absolutely fascinating situation, absolutely interesting policy development, and something, you know, at the scale we've never seen anywhere in the country. And so I'll let you get into the details, but basically towards the end of the year, due to a variety of factors, more than 50% of all of the product in the Mississippi market was subject to an administrative hold due to problems with the testing lab. If you could imagine what that would do to any market, cannabis or otherwise, if 50% of the available supply was subject to seizure and could not be sold, let's just say it jacked things up a little bit. I think there's a lot of lessons learned here and a lot of things to be paying attention to around the country. Everybody in cannabis should be aware. Every regulator, every policymaker, every business owner should be aware of what's going on and thinking about the risk associated impact that this will have. So Henry, given that context, can you give us the specifics of kind of what happened and triggered the situation in Mississippi?
So I can give you what I know. Unfortunately, the investigation into the testing lab is still ongoing. So there's really no public facts on the ground yet. But from what we've been told, there was an anonymous phone call made to the Department of Health in regards to certain discrepancies within certificate of analysis results or test results when it came to certain cannabis products. Coming from one of the two labs that we had open at the end of last year. And so on the 20th of December of last year, the Department of Health temporarily suspended the license of one of our testing labs. That testing lab, unfortunately, was doing approximately 70% of the testing for the market. So indirectly, as a result of the suspension, the products that they had tested were placed on administrative hold, and the Department of Health has contracted another lab. Actually, as of mid-January, there are two labs that are currently working on retesting every product that is currently on administrative hold, and they are slowly bringing those products back online week after week. Like I said, we really don't know other than what the Department of Health has told us, and what they have told us is very limited. We do know that the retesting process is underway. We really have no idea how much they have left to retest, but products have made it back onto dispensary shelves, mostly cannabis flower. So there has been a delay in the retesting of cannabis concentrates and edible products, which we hope the Department of Health will remedy sooner rather than later, because we know that there are patients out there that prefer those product types that are currently limited in their ability to purchase those.
Yeah. And, while there are a bunch of unknowns, I think that there are a tremendous number of lessons that we can start talking about and kind of factors here that we do know. And I think we know enough to start thinking really about what this means, right? So first of all, one of the factors that you brought up that I think is really important to talk about is that Mississippi had at that time two testing labs. So this isn't a program that had been open for 6 months. This isn't some new program where people don't know about the business and the industry and the opportunity. We had a robust medical marijuana program in Mississippi with a traditional, almost unremarkable testing program. And I mean that in a positive way, in the sense that their Mississippi testing program looked like, you know, based on best practices, best programs around the country, very consistent with what we would expect to see, nothing anomalous in their testing program, yet only two testing labs in the entire state opened up. Right there in and of itself, I think one of the lessons here is that presents systemic risk to the entire market, the lack of testing labs that ended up opening up for whatever reason they did. But we don't spend a lot of time talking about the economics of testing labs, the viability of the testing lab business. They're a smaller part of the market. They're not the ones focused on the policies as much outside of the testing program. But obviously, economic viability and the fact that a testing lab would be seen as an attractive investment opportunity, as demonstrated by the situation in Mississippi, thinking about that is actually far more critical than I think the attention it's due, because as we see, one problem, one grain of sand, the entire system in Mississippi has seized up now.
Yeah, unfortunately, approximately 70% of the product across the market has been quarantined. So yeah, it's taken a significant impact on the market here in Mississippi.
Yeah, and so you have two testing labs. One of them has a problem, anonymous tips, not, you know, problems with, you know, incompatible certificates of analysis. It almost doesn't matter why, right? Like the why is kind of rudimentary, right? Like I don't think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from, hey, this testing lab made mistakes. They got their license suspended. And critically, the products that they had tested, those tests were deemed to essentially have been, you know, invalid, right? So you had kind of a dual situation of one lab had 70% of the market. Now the lab that only had 30% of the market is the only lab that's left standing. So any new product that needs to get tested, you know, they're not going to magically like be able to just absorb 100% of the market overnight, right? Like that's a huge bottleneck for the entire system for new products, let alone the fact that now all the products, 70% of all the products on shelves were essentially quarantined because the testing that they had undergone was determined to be insufficient or problematic in some way, regardless of why, right? Like, as we find out more from the Department of Health about why, you know, I think that'll flesh out the story. But I think the issue that we're trying to focus on here and why I think this is such an important starting point to some of the focus on testing is the entire market seized up. Like, I, you know, and so can you share a little bit of, you know, now that we're starting to see this kind of loosen up a little bit and more products, like what have dispensaries been seeing? Like what was the consequence? Like 70% of the market gets seized up. People don't totally understand why. What were dispensary shelves look like? Like, can we just talk a little bit, because you work with so many operators, like what was their experience like?
It was, you know, devastating to say the least. I would say, you know, I've visited a number of dispensaries since the testing lab situation has unfolded. And, you know, they look pretty bare. You know, the dispensary shelves look pretty empty. They've, you know, almost every dispensary has had to essentially repurchase their entire inventory without being able to sell their original inventory, which has taken a massive financial toll on our dispensary operators. And then when it comes to producers, you know, all of the concentrates and edible products are still on administrative hold. So they still can't sell any of their products. So I think, you know, our processing facilities are taking an even bigger financial toll as a result of this. And, you know, indirectly, our patients are, you know, they do not have the access that they were used to at the end of last year. They can no longer go into their favorite dispensary and pick up the product that they've found works best for them. You know, that they're having to make different decisions about which products to purchase, which, you know, can cause, you know, a real toll on our patients. So, you know, we can only hope that the Department of Health, you know, sees to resolving this matter sooner rather than later. But it has been a long and arduous process, and we're now at, you know, almost two full months of the retesting situation. And to be honest with you, there's really no end in the short term in sight that we can see. You know, I've spoken to the lab that has been tasked with retesting these products, and like you said, you know, they went from having approximately 30% of the market share to now having 100% of the market share for new and naive testing. But not only that, but they have been tasked with retesting all of the products that were placed on administrative hold as a result of this suspension. Luckily, at the middle of January, another testing lab has come online in northeastern Mississippi, and they have dedicated their entire lab to just retesting some of these products on administrative hold. So that has benefited the process. It's definitely better than just having one lab responsible for all of these retests. But it's still, you know, it's been a very long process, and every day our operators are suffering as a result.
Yeah, and so I mean, like, again, sometimes it's great to take things like piece by piece, because there was just so much, I think, perspective that you just shared from the various windows, right? So dispensaries starting there and up the supply chain, there's no notice or warning for anything like this, right? Like you can't, like the nature of these types of crises, they don't have a, hey guys, heads up, in a week, this is going to happen. So you wake up, you go to work, and 70% of the market, in turn 70% of what you have on your shelves, is now subject to administrative hold and can't be sold. So first you freak out and you try to figure out why, and then you figure out how long it's going to be. And then you realize it ain't going to end anytime soon. And you're like, okay, well, I've, you know, I have all of this product on my shelf. I, first of all, I need to get new product like as quickly as possible to keep my cash flow going. To the extent that you've paid in advance for those products, that you're not on payment terms, you have money laid out that's kind of locked up. In the converse, obviously, if you're on payment terms, your producers got their cash locked up that they were getting. So everyone's cash flow is now under significant financial pressure, right? What they were expecting from an in and outflow is completely turned upside down with no notice and warning. And not because they did anything wrong, right? What they did was completely fine. And it's not to dog on the regulators and how they handled it. Once we kind of get to the end of this and have more information, maybe we will have some, you know, kind of constructive criticisms of how the regulators handled it. But it's premature to even say that. So through what we would expect to be reasonable, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say reasonable, normal course of action by a regulatory agency, the entire market gets seized up. Now, all the pressure that's put on those dispensaries flows up the supply chain to the producers, right? And you mentioned them, which I think is really important because they have all of their product out in the market frozen, and they've got to find a way to get new stuff on the shelves and to get it tested when the only lab that does it needs to increase their output by 333%, which, you know, I'm not sure many businesses could overnight increase their throughput by that much.
Certainly not. I know that the lab that is doing all the retesting, they have increased capacity significantly. They've brought in new machines. They brought in new testers from out of state in order to supplement this retesting process. But still, like you said, I mean, expanding your capacity by, you know, over 300% in a matter of days or weeks is sort of unfeasible for most businesses. I think this testing lab has done the best they possibly could have under the circumstances. And we are grateful, you know, as an industry to have the lab, you know, make those sacrifices. I mean, these people, you know, they purchased those new machines, you know, at cost, like they're taking significant financial risks in order to, you know, meet the requirements of this retesting, which, you know, we can't thank them enough for their dedication to this program.
Yeah, because right, what happens when things normalize and all of a sudden they're back down to testing, maybe more, right, than 30%, maybe their market share increases, but like it probably isn't gonna, you know, it might not increase to the level of the capacity that they've essentially bought to. And if you understand the lab business, it's a volume business, right? Their equipment is very expensive. Their people are very expensive. So you have to have the volume to justify the people and the equipment. And so, yeah, everyone is kind of taking a tremendous financial hit and financial risk throughout the supply chain, top to bottom. And then you get the patients who obviously the entire program is for. And you know, for those of us who've been around long enough, medical patients tend to be, in a great sense, creatures of habit, right? They identify a product, a strain, whatever works for them. They stick to that stuff usually pretty consistently. So if you have a bunch of sick people who are like, this is the product that helps me, and then it just vanishes from the supply chain for what is now 2 months and you know, kind of very choppy stuff, you have a lot of sick people who aren't getting what they need. And throughout the entire system, there has been havoc wrought. And I think that that's why we wanted to start here and why we kind of almost have been watching this and talking to you guys about this in Mississippi. And then we get on calls with folks from all over the country, different industry associations and businesses and regulators that we talk to on a regular basis. And it was like, why is nobody talking about what's happening in Mississippi? like, this is just like we were talking with Brian Vicente, that Ohio wasn't on people's radar the way that you would think it is. This situation in Mississippi to me has been like, this is one of the most critical cannabis policy stories and industry and market stories going on around the country. And most people aren't talking about it. And I could not emphasize more the importance of understanding what happened, why it happened, and doing work in every state to kind of mitigate this systemic risk that we are all subjected to because of the nature of cannabis product safety.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it just speaks to the need for increased testing capacity across the state. And, you know, if other medical states or states that are, you know, implementing a medical cannabis program in the future, if they can learn a lesson from Mississippi, I think it's that, you know, at the very beginning of your program, you need to have adequate testing capacity for the market, or you're going to create a bottleneck. And, you know, in extreme cases like this, you're going to create, you know, an extreme financial burden and essentially a breakdown of the program itself. So just as a forewarning for anyone listening to this podcast.
Like redundant capacity almost.
No, I agree. Yes, there definitely needs to be redundant capacity for testing in this program. I think it's, you know, this situation is an example for others to learn from, that, you know, in a program like this, you need to ensure that products can get tested, you know, in a reasonable and timely fashion in order to make it to dispensary shelves, in order to provide access to patients. I think at the beginning of this program, you know, before the testing lab in question that's had their license suspended was in fact the first lab to open in the state. And then, you know, we had another lab come on in the middle of, I think, 2022. But still, I think, you know, from the advice we got, you know, especially from you guys at the beginning of this program, I think, you know, four or five labs just for the small fledgling program that we have here in Mississippi was necessary at the very beginning. I think that was the advice, you know, we received from you guys. Unfortunately, you know, we have no, you know, influence over personal business investment or personal decisions to open a lab, but, you know, we're certainly, you know, expecting more labs to come online. Luckily, we have right now four licensed laboratories. We expect at least two of which to come online within the first half of this year. So that will give us, you know, some breathing room to move forward in this market. You know, we currently have a little over 37,000 patients in the state of Mississippi. But if we're successful at the Capitol this year with, you know, all of the changes that we discussed earlier in this podcast, we expect to see exponential growth in patients. You know, we could easily double to triple our patient count over the next 12 to 18 months, which means that we are going to need more capacity to test more products to provide those products to our patients.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I think that's important to know, right? Because what we don't want to do is like chill anybody's excitement about Mississippi. Like, many new labs are coming online, but what's kind of, you know, thought, what makes me think about this is Mississippi has, you know, a pretty robust and open market. They have a large list of qualifying conditions. It has all the things that you would look at a medical market to say, is this market going to work and operate and have, you know, viable ROI? Yes. Does Mississippi's testing program look most like most testing programs in other states? Yes. But for some reason, only a couple of labs opened up in the first few years. So there must have been something in the business case that gave people pause. And then when that happened, the state wasn't able to recruit enough new labs and new entrepreneurs to come into the state. And all of a sudden, this massive systemic risk comes to bear. And I think everybody in the industry needs to look at what happened and say, okay, how do we mitigate this risk? How can regulators mitigate this risk in the future? How can industry members mitigate this risk in the future? How can policymakers, how can advocates, how can people who do what you and I do, how can we all work together to kind of understand how big of a systemic risk this was, how catastrophic this has been for these businesses. Like, my guess is this wasn't in anybody's pro forma, and everybody up and down the supply chain took it in the teeth. So what can we do to mitigate that risk? And I think that that's, we have to make sure our products are safe. Like, whether we're talking about the problems and the things that you discussed around intoxicating hemp, or why the regulated market is better than the illicit market, our main competitive advantage over the illicit market, especially in states like Colorado, where folks aren't really worried about getting arrested very much, is the fact that products have go through product safety protocols and testing. That's our best advantage. So we need this aspect of the industry. It's critical that our products are safe for consumers and patients. But at the same time, how can we do that in a way that does not create massive systemic risk for everybody up and down the supply chain? And that as the situation in Mississippi continues to unfold, we start to gain more information, but we also really start to digest what happened and start really brainstorming about ways to, you know, you can't take all risk off the table. That's not how it works, but to mitigate it, I think it's really important to pay attention to what's going on in Mississippi and collaborating with our colleagues in Mississippi about what they're doing, how they solved it, so that those lessons can be brought to bear in other states beyond just, well, we need more testing labs. It's like, well, that's nice. We need more testing labs, but that's not an overnight magic thing. You don't wave a wand. Like, you need an entrepreneur to think, okay, it's a good business opportunity for me to open a testing lab. And what are we doing to entice those entrepreneurs to ensure that the system has its stability?
Agreed. Yeah. And I just want to speak just for a moment about the actual process of opening a lab here in Mississippi. You know, the test method validation process for a cannabis testing lab here in Mississippi is a long and arduous process. It's usually a, you know, 3 to 6 to 8 month process from beginning to end. So, you know, as someone that potentially would be looking to open a cannabis testing lab, you know, here in Mississippi or in another medical state, you know, I would suggest that you start as early as possible, because that process takes a significant amount of time. You know, I know the two labs that I spoke about earlier that we expect to come online sometime early this year, you know, that they have been in that process of test method validation for, you know, at least the middle of last year. So, you know, the act of opening up a cannabis testing lab is significantly longer compared to, say, a cultivation facility or dispensary. So just wanted to make that known that, you know.
Yeah, but that's not unique to Mississippi,
no.
Right? Like, I think that that's also consistent is, you know, they've got the added layer. So when you're building out any other kind of cannabis facility, it takes some time. And everybody knows, you know, building department, fire department, zoning, setbacks, all of these things in terms of just getting your doors open and property are expensive and take time. But the issue that you're talking about with labs is there's this added layer of regulatory kind of oversight where you have to have your methods approved. And that means you've got to have your doors open and your building going, but then you're not servicing customers. You're kind of in this pre-approval phase where you need to get through that, and that takes time. So yeah, lead time is also one of the very important things to consider as we move forward. So, you know, with that, Henry, I just want to thank you so much to take all this time with us today on your birthday. Nonetheless, you know, I don't think you necessarily thought, you know, my favorite thing to do on my birthday is to come on a podcast and talk about cannabis policy, but you're just wonky enough that you are willing to carve the time out. The first ever birthday Weed Wonks episode, the first ever Weed Wonk, as you are, to come on and join us on your birthday. So above all, thank you very much, and hope you have a very awesome and happy rest of your birthday. But you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, and we will certainly be checking back in with you as we do all the time, and I get to talk to you more regularly, but also on the show as well to kind of keep us up to date on all the great things that are happening in the state of Mississippi.
I appreciate it, Jordan. Thank you both for having you and Josh for having me on here. I'm glad I could make history with being the first birthday podcast for the Weed Wonks. And hopefully, you know, I did a good enough job where you guys will invite me back on.
Yeah, it's been awesome. It's been great working with you as always. And absolutely, we will definitely have you back on, and just excited about the amazing future that we've all set the table for in Mississippi, and expect awesome things to come. So thank you so much for your time. And as always, stay nerdy, everybody.